probably for the rest of the run, is the concept of kfiya, which is a theme that we touched upon in the context of the staka, but particularly how it connects to a highly sensitive and controversial and relevant topic, b'zman hazeh, in the area of gittin. It's a topic that we read about all the time. It's considered to be a current crisis, a challenge to the Orthodox community, that on the one hand, a get is the only way to end a marriage when the husband and wife are both still living. And the only way that can happen, we'll see over the next few days some of the makoros of why this is, the only way that can happen is by the husband willingly issuing a get. So that being the case, we find nowadays, particularly because we live in a fragmented society, particularly because we don't have one central Beis Din that regulates all of us, we don't have a very cohesive community or anything remotely like it, so the situation can unfold, as we know that it certainly has, where a husband will refuse to give a get, and therefore cause tremendous, tremendous suffering to his wife and to his family, and all kinds of terrible problems. So how exactly can that be dealt with? Can it be dealt with? To what extent can it be dealt with is one of the major issues of contemporary concern. And most of the relevant sugyas are not necessarily from Maseches Gittin, but are from Maseches Ksuvos. So we thought that this year, while Yeshiva is learning Ksuvos, we'll take the opportunity to look at those sugyas and to get a little bit of a context about that, and hopefully we'll come out with a deeper understanding of what's possible and what's not possible. So when we say that the sugyas are mostly in Maseches Ksuvos, just to give you a little bit of headlines of what they are, so the topic of kfiya in general, the idea that somebody can be influenced, let's say, to put it mildly, or can be coerced to do something within the framework of halacha, so that, both in the context of Gittin and in the context of other mitzvot, is really rooted in the Maseches Ksuvos as much as anywhere else. We suggested at the beginning of the semester that there is a theme within Ksuvos of general interpersonal responsibility, spouses to each other, but also even more broadly, the whole community to each other, and that was how we got into staka for the past few weeks. So the theme of kfiya, clearly one of the major details, one of the major components of the discussion, is in Ksuvos at least as much as anywhere else. And as we'll see, particularly this will be the first topic that we'll talk about, that one of the questions we have to ask is to what extent is any potential kfiya in the context of a get related to or not related to general kfiya by mitzvos? Are these two separate sugyas? Are they interrelated sugyas? That's really essentially our first area to figure out. And then once we talk about that, so then we'll have to consider the question of when is kfiya a possibility, if it is a possibility. So that will draw upon the sugya of Mois Alai, which is a topic of a major machlokas rishonim, one of the most significant issues that affects the contemporary question of dissolving marriages, b'zman hazeh. So that as well is a ksuvos sugya primarily, so we'll be talking about that. And then probably after some time with those sugyas, maybe we'll consider also some of the suggestions that have been put forward in the contemporary discourse as to are there alternative ways of dissolving marriages even without a get. So among those are the question of, let's say, Kiddushei Tos. Is there a circumstance in which a marriage can be understood to have been flawed from the outset, and therefore maybe doesn't even need a get? And that's also a topic which draws on Gemara's and Maseches Ksuvos. And perhaps in an even more controversial sense, the sugya of Afki'inu Rabbanan L'Kiddushin Mineh, the idea that maybe under some circumstances the Beis Din has the authority to nullify, to negate the marriage, or what's known in other religions as to annul a marriage. To what extent is there such a possibility within halacha? That's also a sugya that appears in a number of places, but also in the Maseches Ksuvos. So to consider all of those different sugyas which are relevant to that question, again, all of those are ksuvos sugyas, so we'd like to take the opportunity to use our ksuvos year to consider all those points. So in the few minutes that we have left for today, so let's just start, if you saw, and you saw the first Mar Makom highlighted the fact that we have some synergy, right, that it's this week's parasha, the very beginning of this week's parasha. If it was Revi, we could delay the point until Thursday, but it's from Rishon, so we can mention it today, that the sugya of Kfiya could, on one level, be rooted in a pasuk in Parshas Vayikra. So, based on what you've seen so far from today's Makoros, so what fundamental questions could you ask about Kfiya? Or what do you have to try to figure out? And we should emphasize, of course, that nowadays one could even ask, what role does Kfiya have if indeed we are living in a fragmented society and we're living both legally and practically in a society where we don't have the same kind of influence on each other, and we're living in a country which brings with it many blessings, but obviously also limits the extent to which one can involve himself in the religious activities of another individual. So how much does that play a role? And presumably it plays a big role, and a lot of the issues of kfiya are theoretical, but the theory is also important, because it tells us a little bit about some of the moving parts here, and especially when we transfer over to Gittin, so we know that there are practicalities we're going to have to try to assess as well. So what fundamental questions strike you as you see these Gemaras about Kfiya? So are there any primary issues you think that we have to resolve, should try to keep on our agenda? Sammy?
Maybe is we have to figure out if Kfiya is really accomplishing the goal that we set out to accomplish.
Okay, so you're asking practically, you're saying, well, maybe Kfiya exists in the books, but maybe it's not a good idea, or are you asking a more fundamental level?
I'm asking that.
The first question. Right, so that's one practical issue. So what you're basically saying is that maybe, when I was just saying a few minutes ago about it being more theoretical, so maybe the Gemaras are telling us, and if you want to talk most plainly, so it's really the first Gemara here on Peivav Amud Aleph. Right? But that Gemara, which is most often cited throughout all the passages in all the Sfarim Halacha talk about Kfiya, so really ground zero for Kfiya is Peivav Amud Aleph and Ksubas, which says in kind of a backdoor way that we have kfiya for mitzvah saseh. And the Gemara really isn't very explicit at all. You have to kind of figure out what all the references are. But the Gemara says that if one assumes that priyas bal chov is a mitzvah, the idea that you have to pay back your debt, it's not simply something that comes automatically out of the fact that you borrowed money or that you incurred a debt somehow, but there is a specific mitzvah to pay back your debt, then it can be viewed through the prism of mitzvos like any other mitzvah. So says the Gemara, I'm a layer of Kahana, layer of Papa. This is five lines from the bottom of Peivav Amud Aleph. L'didach d'amras priyas balchov mitzvah. So if you're going to say that that's how we should view priyas balchov as a mitzvah, and let's say not necessarily focusing on it being a monetary shibud, but rather a personal obligation on the individual, so what would happen if a person would say, Amar lo nichali di avid mitzvah? What if a person would say that he's not interested in doing a mitzvah? Okay, so you're telling me that I have a moral responsibility to pay back my loans. Well, I'm not so religious, right? So I don't want to pay back my loans. Now what are you going to do to me? So my, what would the story be? So Amar le, he said to him, Tanina v'medvar mamurim, what were we talking about? What were we talking about when? So Rashi explains, Dalok Arbayim, that you could have a application of Malkos, when would we say such a thing? B'mitzvah lo saseh. Aval b'mitzvah saseh, if someone is involved in negating a mitzvah saseh, he could go and sha'omrim lo, like they say to him, asay sukkah, v'eino oseh, they tell him to make a sukkah, and he's not going to do it, lulav v'eino oseh, so then, makin oso ad shiteitze nafsho. So then we can hit him, achitate se nafsho, whatever that means. Now again, here we should probably emphasize, especially because we'll run out of time, so no one should leave here with too much enthusiasm from this. Do not try this at home. And what exactly achitate se nafsho means is itself, it's certainly a very striking phrase, no pun intended, but the idea that you're going to bring somebody within an inch of his life is a little bit of a scary thought. And you saw, for example, it's called the Shittim. It's actually a pretty long passage in Shittim HaKubetzes that's really focused on one line specifically. What does Shita Mikubetza say about this sentence? Joel?
That if you don't have an idea of exactly where his tolerance is, you can keep hitting him, but if you do know how much he can withstand, then obviously you should not reach that point.
Right, essentially, we're not actually talking about taking away his nefesh, but that the Shita Mikubetza has the phrase, Shiyakulish Koko, that you weaken him a little bit, you take away his resistance, but it's not really meant as dramatically as it sounds, but essentially just to make the point that there is this coercive tool, theoretically, which is available. Now, there are all kinds of questions one could ask just from the Gemara itself, so I'd like to try to isolate some of those questions, and we'll pick up on it tomorrow. One the question that Sammy was asking, in a practical sense, if we say that, practically speaking, maybe we do this, maybe we don't do this now, so Sammy was suggesting that maybe one of the considerations is, well, maybe we have to figure out just how effective it is. That maybe there are contexts in which this is an effective way to enhance religious observance, and maybe in other contexts it's not, and therefore maybe that's why we shouldn't do it. If that's the case, by the way, it's evocative of other concepts, including at least one well-known passage in the Gemara. What passage seems to make such a point about another technique? Well, that's more similar to this, but I'm saying the idea that maybe it's theoretically there, but practically counterproductive. Want to comment on that?
Yeah,
Tochacha, right? The Gemara says in the middle of Maseches Erechin that Tochacha is a mitzvah in the Torah, which makes it more explicit than this reference. It's an explicit mitzvah in the Torah. And yet, the Gemara seems to suggest that maybe we're not so good at doing Tochacha effectively nowadays, and it could theoretically be counterproductive. And the Gemara is saying nowadays, meaning then a days, in the days of the Gemara, meaning that even back then, they had lost the ability to effectively convince people to change their behavior with Tochacha. So says the Gemara, and maybe this is a good way of expressing what Sammy was alluding to, that Kishem Shemitzvah Lomar Davar Hanishma, Kach Mitzvah Lo Lomar Davar She'eino Nishma, that just as we're doing this because we want it to be heard and to be effective, so too we could say that don't do it if it's not going to be effective. That'll be counterproductive. So one could say that you have such a possible application here, which is a fair question to ask. But before you get to that, you should ask a more fundamental question, Sam.
I was just wondering, is it really based in this place to hit somebody and give them up for something which to do a mitzvah ase?
So that itself, you're asking from a more fundamental level, that
right.
You say mitzvah ase as opposed to a los ase?
Yeah.
So flesh that out a little bit. Why would you distinguish? Why would you think
that? I understand there's explicit reasons not to do an ase. You're kind of, forcing something upon him. It's kind of it seems to be like a lack of clear on his part.
So you're onto something, but let's flesh out a little bit more. So why is that less of a Bechira issue than if the person is doing the Los Aseh? You seem to be okay with punishing somebody for a Los Aseh. Right? So why should we, and I'm not wrong, but why should you distinguish? Why would you think that maybe a Los Aseh we could hear, especially here, what's striking, again, I'm not intentionally using that phrase, just seems appropriate each time, that what's striking here is that really what the Gemara is maybe sounding like, whatever agitation afshal means, is that it means it's essentially possibly unlimited. It could mean many, many malchus, more than arba'in, in which case it's actually telling us that there could be a more aggressive treatment here than somebody who violates the los aseh. So your understandable comment that the los aseh you could hear, but maybe not for an aseh, what this Gemara seems to be saying for some reason is the other way around, that maybe an aseh will get even more aggressive treatment than a los aseh. Have you wanted to comment on that?
Some mitzvahs ases, you're not like mechuyev to do. You're not mechuyev to do, especially you're not mechuyev to do right then and now. So why should they?
So you're fleshing out the question a little more. You're saying that one of the reasons why you can maybe hear it for a los aseh is, I think, understand what you're getting at, is that a los aseh, it's much easier to point to the moment of violation and to clearly identify a violation. And when it comes to an aseh, so the concept of bitul aseh, when one actively negates an aseh, is difficult to pinpoint. So the idea that we could even have a context in which to take any kind of aggressive action within Aseh is tricky on a couple levels. First of all, when are you Mavakal? And this, by the way, so for example, if you consider the question of Bris Milah, so this was a topic of a major Machlokas, the Rishonim, the Rambam, the Ravid, and others, that we know that there is a punishment for being Mavakal, the Aseh of Milah. The Torah says one is subject to Karis if one does not get a Bris Milah. And the Rishonim have to struggle to figure out what that means, because when do you incur karis? If one commits the transgression, okay, so we say you did the Aveira now, so you're subject to punishment now. But if we're talking about a positive mitzvah, how do we even identify a time when that happens? So that itself is a challenge we have here also. So the Rishonim have to figure out what those words mean in the context of Milah. It's a topic of a big debate. And here too, isn't that inherently an issue? When do you say that somebody is indeed in violation of an aseh? And then you also added to the question that isn't it true that the chiyuv is often more ambiguous to begin with? When it comes to alos aseh, we can say, all right, you're clearly doing something wrong. When it comes to the aseh, so maybe there are excuses, which comes up, by the way, in other contexts, that we find that in terms of identifying, let's say you have a katan or somebody who's otherwise patur from mitzvos, and the whole question of should we say even if you're exempt from mitzvos, should you do mitzvos anyway in order to be identifiable as a Jewish person? So then there's a discussion, what's more identifiable, somebody who avoids los aseis or somebody who does not perform a mitzvah aseh? Or somebody who does perform mitzvah aseh? Because each one you could say, well, if you're not performing a mitzvah saseh, maybe you're just not doing it now, maybe you're doing it later. The fact that you don't do a mitzvah saseh doesn't necessarily tell us anything about your commitment to the mitzvah saseh, looking at you at this moment in time. This comes up practically, by the way. This is a totally disregarded point nowadays, but in a few weeks it'll be Chol HaMoed, and there is a major machlokas about wearing tefillin on Chol HaMoed, and there are many different practices, right? Basically, every single Jewish male in the world wears tefillin on Chol HaMoed, every single one, with the exception of briskers, chassidim, gronik, svardim, Israelis, and about 10 other categories. Right? So it's a big machlokas. So one of the issues the poskim actually seem to agree upon is whatever you do, you shouldn't have one context where half is doing one and half is doing the other, because they felt that violates the Torah prohibition of losas godidu. You shouldn't have visibly divided practice. So nowadays, you don't find any Eretz Yisrael, they're actually very machmen on that. They don't wear tefillin on Chol HaMoed, they don't allow anybody to wear tefillin in public on Chol HaMoed. And in America, so this concern isn't really so respected. In most rituals, you'll find some people wearing tefillin and some people not wearing tefillin. So poskim will talk about that, so they note that the people who are not wearing tefillin are in a little bit of a more defensible position in such a mixed group than people who are wearing tefillin. Because people who are wearing tefillin are clearly doing something that is different from the other half. While people who aren't wearing tefillin, we don't know that they're clearly deviating, because maybe they wore tefillin before, but they just took it off for a minute, they'll wear tefillin later, they don't have the tefillin right now. So essentially it makes the point that at any given moment, seeing someone not performing a mitzvah saseh is not necessarily indicative of anything. So that's also part of Avi's question, that I can identify someone as clearly transgressive if I see him doing something wrong. But a person who's failing to do a mitzvah saseh, so doesn't that in many ways differentiate itself from a lo saseh? Other question?
Well, that seems to be similar to the concept of hasra safek.
Okay.
Right? But even for certain mitzvahs lo saseh, there's no way to enforce malchus on someone because...
Right, so real malchus, they're
right. Right, because there can't be a hasra, so that's similar.
So you're all the more so if you're talking about a mitzvah saseh.
Right, there's no...
Right, okay, so that's one of the questions.
So I'm going to hold somebody culpable enough to lash them if we have no way of informing them in a bad way that they're in violation, so to speak, of not performing a bitalase until after the Zman pass, and then you can no longer give them malchus. If somebody didn't take a lulav on Sukkos, then the I think it's quoted in the, I want to say in the Betzes, in one of the, but that once the, if it's mitzvah averus, once the mitzvah averus is over, you can no longer be malchus.
So then already it's too late to begin.
Right, so it seems to be
like a catch 22, right, that either there's still time left to do it, or there's no time left to do it and there's no point. Now, speaking of there end up being no time left and no point. So that itself, saying there's no point itself brings up an interesting issue. So just I'll have to rush this process because of our pending time out. But one of the points we'll have to try to figure out is, so what's kind of under the surface of a lot of these statements is, if we're talking about an onesh, this becomes difficult. Right? And maybe this is an onesh of some kind. But maybe it's not. And maybe we should not approach this through the lens of onesh and through the lens of something else. And what you just said about if the time of the mitzvah is over, there's no point. Well, if it was an onesh, there could be a point. And you could be punished for negating a mitzvah saseh. And once the opportunity is truly over and you can't do anything about it, then yes, you have conclusively been mevatel it, and that's why you're being punished. So the fact that that doesn't seem to be an option also illustrates that maybe this isn't about an onesh, it's about something else. So what is it about then? Kiba?
So there can be two, generally we speak about two possible reasons for action like this can take: punitive, which is onesh, and therapeutic is probably not the word here.
Rehabilitative?
Rehabilitative, correct.
Right.
Yeah, that's the word. So it could be not to, like, you know, or not as punitive or deterrent, but as, you know, you should really get around to doing that.
So as a encouragement.
Yeah.
In the kind of mob sense of the word.
Negative reinforcement.
Or, yeah, or pre-enforcement in this case.
Yeah.
Right. So, Avi?
Kind of like an extreme version of Tokhava.
Oh, maybe not an extreme version, maybe an outgrowth of tochacha, right? So there are those who understand this as a tochacha-related din. If not tochacha, what other model might you have besides tochacha? Which actually may not be so distinct from tochacha. But what's another idea that we find in halacha? Cheirem, right, so that may also be a method of communal encouragement. But Knas, these are all tools, right? That's tools of what? So tools of tochacha, or there's another idea that we have that we find throughout the halacha of arvis. Right? They're called Yisrael Arevim Zebozeh. So maybe that's at the root of what's going on, that we have some type of interpersonal responsibility here, and therefore you are missing out on the mitzvah is going to be our problem too. Avi?
Can tochacha be within arvis?
Within what? Sorry? Yes, that's why they're not necessarily such distinct concepts. They're distinct concepts in the sense that the Torah has tocha as an independent mitzvah, and arvus is derived from other psukim in the Chumash. So it seems like you could have one without the other, that they have, clearly have overlapping themes, but they seem to exist independently of each other. So we have to figure out what exactly is the root of kviyah. Right? What is kviyah? So is it arvus, is it tocha, is it something else? What exactly is the motive of kviya? Is it punishment or is it encouragement? Is it to try to get the mitzvah to be fulfilled? And how does that affect the parameters? Kiva?
From the lashon of kviya, you are forcing somebody to do something. It doesn't seem to be punitive.
The very language itself, right, does not sound punitive. I think you're right that the context, and maybe even specifically this Gemara, which is also interesting because if you look at the Gemara here, it doesn't even really use the word kviya, even though this is the source. You know, you'll see in hundreds of svarim, oh, kofen al mitzvahs kediisa the ksubas pebav medalev, that phrase doesn't really even exist here. That's just the upshot of the kviya, which is itself interesting. So maybe there is room to interpret it differently, but the idea of kviya certainly does sound like we're talking about a proactive desire to get something done rather than to punish something that didn't get done. So, any other questions? Yes?
I don't know if this is too related to Sam's, but it might. Sam mentioned that it was going to be like counterproductive, but it might not be counterproductive. It might just not accomplish what we want at all. You know,
okay, why not?
You, fundamentally, if you're forcing, we brought this up by tzedakah, that you might force someone to do something, but if that thing that you're forcing them to do needs to be done willingly,
okay.
It doesn't really work.
So, that's a very important question. And that question exists on a couple levels, and we'll certainly have to talk about that tomorrow. That's what exactly are we accomplishing by forcing somebody to do a mitzvah? So will this mitzvah indeed be fulfilled? And you could ask that question from at least two ways. One is that we know that there are certain dinim that inherently have a requirement of ratzon, get being one of them, right? We know that a get has to be through the free will of the Baal, so therefore is there not an inherent contradiction between kfiya and the perfect issuance of a get? And that was, we saw that in the context of the carbon also. Right, so that's one question we'll have to figure out. And the question too, that even if a concept isn't specifically associated with ratzon, let's say it's a normal mitzvah, lulav and sukkah and the like, but is this really a mitzvah to be doing it at gunpoint? Is that really any, are you really accomplishing anything klapei shmaya? Will you show up after 120 and claim credit for this? And will you be successful in claiming credit for this? So that's itself a very, very important question. Right? So this question that has been asked, is this productive or counterproductive? So one angle to ask it is just sound in terms of psychology, are you having a good effect or a bad effect? Like the Gemara about Tochefa seems to be focusing on, Davar HaNishma and Davar HaShe'eino Nishma. But even without that, let's assume it will result in the mitzvah taking place and won't result in discouraging any mitzvahs. Let's stipulate that for a minute. But what is the value of this mitzvah? What is the value of a mitzvah if the halacha specifically demands ratzon? And even if it doesn't, what is being accomplished? Just like from a different place, we had that question by Stucker. And one of the other major issues, which is a little bit alluded to by the Makoros towards the end of the list, so you may not have seen this so much, but one very basic practical question that probably is on your mind in terms of the mechanics of kfiya, who does it? Is this something that all of us are invited to do? Or is this specifically a Beis Din concept? And that has all kinds of implications. Certainly in the get context, right, we say that if there is any room for kfiya, so is this kfiya specifically limited to a formal Beis Din setting, or is it something that individuals could take upon themselves? And of course, that opens up all kinds of dangerous precedents. We could certainly see the downside of allowing individuals to engage in what I guess you might call vigilante encouragement. So is that, what exactly are we talking about? That's a very major point. So just to quickly recap, we're already over time, but again, my apologies for the chatzi shir under the context, but tomorrow should be normal. But God willing, even though again, so some of you still have appointments for tomorrow, but still it shouldn't affect the overall schedule. But basically, what do we want to try to figure out? We want to try to figure out what is the purpose of this kfiya? Is it punitive or is it something else? What is the basis for such action? Is it tochefa? Is it arvus? Is that something else? Is it productive both psychologically and spiritually? Does it accomplish anything if it's done this way? And fourth, what is the process? Who is doing this? Are individuals doing this? Are Bezdin, is a Bezdin doing this? Does it depend on what we're talking about? Does it depend on the methodology? All of these very important fundamental questions. And then from that, we will transition into the more specific Gittin context that comes after that. All right, everyone should have a wonderful day.